Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Saleri Report. This is Money and Markets with John Titus and Catherine Austin Fitz. We're recording on Wednesday, January 17th for publication tomorrow, Thursday, January 18th. And the stories are getting better and better, John, and pushback still in our theme. What's our theme this week?
Yeah, there's so many pushback stories that really, to have a pushback category by itself would kind of dominate the program. And so the stories are now sprinkled throughout the regular subject matter categories. Anyway, the theme this week is going direct reset, meet great pushback.
Wow. Yes. Yes. I finally, wow. Because we were going to do this, I finally went in and looked at what was going on at Davos. And, you know, that's a group of people who are running scared.
Yeah, but they still have lost contact with reality, and
yes,
we have a story on that point.
Yeah,
today,
absolutely, yeah. Absolutely, yeah,
yeah. So you're right. They're running scared on the one hand, but they don't know what to do on the other hand, and they've just utterly without a clue.
Right,
it's quite comical.
No, it's scary.
Actually, it's tragicomic.
But if you think there's no reason to push back, you're wrong. Push back harder.
There's a lot of pushback, and it's coming, again, from a lot of different quarters.
Yeah.
So let's start with genocide in Gaza. This pushback there against, you know, depending on how you look at things, either the U.S. agent, the U.S. aircraft carrier over in the Middle East, otherwise known as Israel, or the U.S. boss, the boss of the U.S., Israel. Anyway, there's pushback against what's going on in Gaza. So I want to run a clip of the International Criminal Justice Court, which, you know, they've been sued. Israel has been sued for genocide by South Africa, and opening arguments were made last week. And I want to run the argument made by, to my way of thinking, the most effective advocate on the South African side, who really lays out the case of what, you know, why it's genocide in Gaza. In basically 2 minutes and 30 seconds, so I'm just going to run this clip and show you. This is Adila Hasim. She's a South African advocate. She's actually educated in the U.S. She was very effective. I looked her up, and she has her Master of Legal Letters at St. Louis University School of Law, a Doctor of Juridical Science. That's what that SJD is, from Notre Dame. I mean, this is a Midwesterner, basically. But anyway, here is her kind of summary of what's going on in Gaza and why it's genocide.
South Africa contends that Israel has transgressed Article 2 of the Convention by committing actions that fall within the definition of genocide. The actions show a systematic pattern of conduct from which genocide can be inferred. Allow me to place these acts in context. Gaza is one of the two constituent territories of the occupied Palestinian territories, occupied by Israel since 1967. It is a narrow strip of approximately 365 square kilometers, as depicted in the map now displayed. Israel continues to exercise control over the space, territorial waters, land crossings, water, electricity, electromagnetic sphere, and civilian infrastructure in Gaza, as well as over key governmental functions. As the Honourable Minister has said, entry and exit by air and sea to Gaza is prohibited, with Israel operating the only two crossing points. Gaza, which is one of the most densely populated places in the world, is home to approximately 2.3 million Palestinians, almost half of them children. For the past 96 days, Israel has subjected Gaza to what has been described as one of the heaviest conventional bombing campaigns in the history of modern warfare. Palestinians in Gaza are being killed by Israeli weaponry and bombs from air, land, and sea. They are also at immediate risk of death by starvation, dehydration, and disease as a result of the ongoing siege by Israel, the destruction of Palestinian towns, the insufficient aid being allowed through to the Palestinian population, and the impossibility of distributing this limited aid while bombs fall. This conduct renders essentials to life unobtainable.
And therein lies the nub of that, is killing people willy-nilly in massive numbers. And part of it is they can't get food, they can't get medicine, they can't get help
right.
while they're being bombed.
So there are two things that are interesting here to me that I want to add. One is Terry Misson just published something on what the South Africa is doing at The Hague with this case. And he points out that the Israelis are not being accused of engineering a genocide. They're being accused of doing things that then allow genocide to occur. It seems to be a very a neat trick in terms of getting them on genocide without having to prove that there is an intentional top-down plan, is what it looks like to me. The second thing is, this happens right after the five Middle Eastern countries, oil producers, go into the BRICS. And South Africa, of course, is a member of the BRICS. And one of my questions, because the Middle Eastern countries are hesitant to do something directly, was this part of the deal of bringing them into the BRICS, that South Africa agreed to do this? Because there's a reason they're playing this role, and they're not doing it on their own.
Could be, yeah.
Right.
I would agree with they're not doing it on their own.
Right.
Yeah. They've got a lot of support. I think other countries have joined them. I want to correct one thing, not correct, but point out one thing. You don't need a top-down plan to infer intent in any kind of Western jurisdiction. Intent can be inferred reasonably from the circumstances. And that's what she's saying. She's saying, look,
right.
you can infer intent from these circumstances. It's basically
right.
your only reasonable inference here is genocidal.
Right. But she, if I understand Misson correctly, and I might not, by saying a commander is doing something which is intentionally genocide, if you have numerous instances of commanders doing things that are genocidal, that it seems to be easier to prove genocide than if you have to prove that they're all part of a top-down plan. Because you can prove...
Which you never do.
Right, right. But no. You can prove genocide. Or
you never have the smoking gun memo saying, I intended to defraud
right.
these people, I intend to kill this... You're never going to get that. No
right.
one would ever go to jail if that was a standard of proof, which is why it's not the standard. It's
right.
not the legal standard.
Right.
It's inferred from the circumstances.
Well, the interesting thing to me, after watching the different... You know, all the videos are available online, is the case seems to be airtight. Wouldn't you say?
It's hard to refute. And Israel batted lead off with the Holocaust, which is in the wrong century, in the wrong millennium, which is a telltale sign that their case isn't good. If you're
right.
going to bat lead off with something that happened back in the 1940s, that's something's wrong with your facts, your fact
right.
pattern. That's what you're falling back on. It's weak.
Well, it's interesting because when I litigated, you had to address spot on the specific allegations made against you, no matter what the politics or the context was.
Right.
That was your, and if you didn't, you were considered to be without a case.
Right. You're Bush League, whatever it was.
Right.
That was always the case.
Right.
If you gotta take things on the merits. You
right.
can't get up in a court and go, well, it's a conspiracy theory. That's not going to work. You can get bounced out of court, if not laughed right out.
Well, anyway. I, for one, would love to know what this is, what is happening on the global stage as a result of this, because this is, I think, it defines the United States as an outright criminal.
I think that's right. The U.S. is way, way behind this. And it tries to pay lip service saying, oh, we're trying to put the brakes on them and, you need to do less genocide. Nothing's really working. It'll be interesting to see how the ICJ, which, by the way, the C is for court, not for criminal. It's International Court of Justice. I misspoke earlier. But you saw there in that video clip, there are 17 judges.
Right.
So, you know, we don't know how this is going to turn out.
No.
But boy, it's not looking good for the away team.
Right.
Anyway. Okay. You ready to keep it? That's all we have for genocide in Gaza. That's just a very tight summary of what the kind of case against Israel is for genocide. It's just a succinct 2.5 minute summary. But unless you have anything to add, let's move to FedWatch. Let's move to Davos, back to Davos.
No, I got a pitch from somebody. Apparently, they said some of the gas is going to Britain, which wouldn't surprise me. But that's my next thing to investigate, is Britain getting some of the gas from the Mediterranean.
Wow.
I don't know. If anybody has any research on that, send it this way. We want to know.
Yeah. For sure. Yeah. Okay, let's go to the World Economic Forum and see. You know, they have their new annual report is out for 2024. And remember, they always list their top risks. Risks meaning they're kind of tipping their hand, like here's where we're going to meddle. Here's what we're going to do next.
Yeah, but a lot of this they get from surveys of their members.
They do survey their members.
Yeah.
But the surveys are from people who are high level intermeddlers. They're tinkerers. And so when they say there's a cybercrime event coming, it's because they are the sponsor of the cybercrime.
Right. Yeah. Or they're in the bubble. It reflects what the thinking is in the bubble.
Yeah.
Right.
That's a great summary.
Right.
Let's peer into the bubble thinking, the latest bubble thinking from 2024 and the risks. Okay. Here we go. Global risks ranked by severity over the short, meaning 2 years. And long term, meaning 10 years. And you can see right here that this is from 2023-2024. Okay. And you'll notice at the top, let's just point this out. Number one, misinformation and disinformation over a 2 year timeline, and it's fifth in the 10 year timeline. Okay. You also have another, so why the purple? What's the purple indicate? Purple indicates technological. That's interesting. Misinformation and disinformation, technological. There's only one that is technological in the 2 year. That's cyber insecurity. And there's cyber insecurity and adverse outcomes of AI technologies in the 10 year. Okay. So that's this year's perception of the bubble thinking of the global risks. So let me move this up a little bit. And I want to bring in the risks from last year. Okay. And here they are. And you'll notice there's only one purple in the 2 year and only one in the 10 year. And this is from 2022, 2023. So what gives here? You know, what's going on is misinformation is a brand new entrant and AI is a brand new entrant. Okay. So they're saying misinformation and disinformation are the number one concerns in the World Economic Forum this year from the bubble thinkers. And then if you look over 2 years and 10 years, they're telling you right here, the 2 year outlook and the 10 year outlook, this is how are things generally going to go. They're saying, look, dark is stormy and turbulent. So right now you have 30% of them saying it's turbulent and stormy. And then in 10 years, the majority are saying turbulent and stormy. And finally, let's just look at this. The current risk landscape, you can see why it's purple, why misinformation and disinformation is purple. Okay, it weighs in at number two. I guess this is the immediate current view on this. It's AI generated misinformation and disinformation, and that's really interesting because what they're saying is, well, we're going to need to censor you because your people are using AI to gin up false stories. And right. we need to clamp down on that and keep and limit things and protect you with just true stories and act stories that aren't AI generated. That's the plan.
So let me ask you something, because I've been watching some of the concern about, you know, people challenged in their bubble by information, some of the comments over at Davos. How much of it is because they're locked in a bubble, they truly don't know what's going on? And they're afraid of hearing what's going on, and they're afraid of it in part because they don't know it's true half the time. And how much of it is they really know if too many people understand what's going on, they're not going to be able to manage the pushback. So how much of it is intelligent fear of the truth, and how much of it is just disassociated fear of the truth?
I'd say 100% of it is they know what's going on. They for sure know that people are pissed and people are aware of what's going on and they're pushing back. And here's their plan to combat it. We're going to censor you like there's no tomorrow.
Right.
They know. And if you don't believe me, let's look at our next story in FedWatch. You ready?
Yep.
Okay, here we go. This is straight from the mouth, from the horse's mouth. This is from a publication called Search Engine Journal, okay? This is from, it talks about a plan in February. Google expands sensitive events policy to limit exploitation of emergencies. Well, what are they talking about here? Now, the bullet points say that Google's updating its ad policy regarding sensitive events. So everything seems okay. This article is by Matt Southern. Matt wastes no time with pronouns and gets right to the story. And here it is. Google has announced an update expanding its sensitive events policy to publishers, aiming to better address ads
and content.
content. Oh, okay. So it's not just ads, it's content running during or about sensitive world events across more of its platforms. Google already has policies in place for ads and YouTube monetization, but this expands the restrictions to Google's publisher network as well. Okay, so what are sensitive events? What do you mean? Well, per the updated policy, a sensitive event is defined as an unforeseen or unexpected situation that poses a significant risk to Google's ability to provide high-quality, relevant information while reducing insensitive content in prominent and monetized features. Okay? Specifically, sensitive events includes those with major social, cultural, or political impact, such as civil emergencies, natural disasters, public health crises, terrorism, conflict, or mass violence. So sensitive events basically means the news. That's right. What that means.
That is exactly. Anything that's news is sensitive content.
Every story has conflict. That's what stories are.
Right.
They're set up conflict resolution. It's an ancient formula. It's 3,000 years old. Okay. But in particular, what they're after is they really don't like victim blaming. So if there's a mass shooting, you know, you heaven forfend, you question, well, are those crisis actors?
Right.
Because that would be blaming the victims.
Right.
But this is the sign that Google is going to clamp down like there's no tomorrow.
Right. And we're going to get to a lawsuit later on, but this also gets to the issue of emergency powers. Because when you combine emergency powers with news, then everything can be censored.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Everything.
Everything.
Right. And don't be surprised when you hear, well, you know, AI has helped generating these things. You know, because the person who did this article went to ChatGPT to do some research. So, you know, it's AI generated.
Right.
I'm telling you, stay away from ChatGPT. All bad.
Really? All bad? I've seen it. I've seen, you know, we had trouble coming up with the title for Pharma Food.
Yeah.
And Robert put it into ChatGPT, and we didn't use any of its suggestions, but it sort of opened our thinking, and it was very helpful.
Yeah. I don't doubt that it's helpful. I've talked to a lot of people who use it. And I'm like,
No. Mm. Anytime you give more information to Microsoft, you know, I've been going back and forth. You know, we're working on the bullion depository plans for different states, just giving input. And I keep telling them, look, the reason we've gotten ourselves in trouble vis-a-vis sovereignty is primarily driven by systems, electronic systems that compromise your system integrity and your financial integrity. So if you're thinking about, you know, installing systems that allow you to liquefy gold and silver, bringing in Bill Gates and Microsoft to run them is really not going to produce, you know, there's the bullion depository will not be a solution. It will make things worse. And there seems to be a difficulty of saying, oh, wait a minute, let me look at what systems those companies are using. Are they putting their data in an Amazon cloud? And then asking the question, under the terms and conditions, does our state have jurisdiction of those systems? Because a lot of times it comes with contracts where you...
Great question.
Yeah, yeah. So we're getting hugely into, you know, does the state have jurisdiction over the, you know, the electron, all the electronic systems in
right.
within its jurisdiction, or have those been termed and conditioned away? And how does the state claw back jurisdiction?
Right.
Right.
That's a fantastic question.
Right.
You need to know the answer to that.
Right. I'm getting deeply yep. into it. It's a whole new world.
Yeah.
Never occurred to me that the state would not, that literally state contracts one by one and terms and conditions could sign away all state jurisdictions to all their digital systems.
Yeah. Right.
Right.
Right. Right. It is frightening.
Right.
You need to know that before you ink any deal with those guys. You're signing a deal with the devil.
Well, I've seen a couple of really smart, capable gold enthusiasts say, oh, this is wonderful. We can liquefy our gold, but they're bringing in Microsoft.
Yeah.
And
nah.
I'm saying, why would you bring in, they can't make the connection between Bill Gates and Microsoft. It's frightening.
But that is frightening. Bill Gates is such a cutout. Guys, you know, ever since his deposition transcript from the
right.
antitrust case in 1998 right. was released, it's like, how does this guy survive? Is anything but an idiot?
He gave NSA a backdoor.
He's a belligerent fool. And
right,
that deposition proves it. And yet he's got his career of like, oh, he's a smart guy.
No.
Are you kidding me?
What can I say? I believe the NSA has the backdoor thing. Anyway, well, okay. Remember when they did a special edition of Windows 95 for government? That's when the money started disappearing.
Interesting. Very,
it's a coincidence.
Curious.
It's,
yes.
it's a coincidence.
Most curious. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, let's keep it going with another story. This is kind of a background story, but it's worth knowing. It's from a publication called Tennessee Stands. I don't know what that is, but it's a really
it's a
good...
It's Gary Humble, who's a great organization. He's a friend and ally.
Yeah, this is really interesting. Transparency, nonprofits, and your tax dollars. Question, did you ever stop to think about how much of your money is being funneled into the hands of nonprofits by way of grants? Probably not, like me. Unlike a government entity, those same nonprofits are not subject to public records requests. So if your government does it, you can file a FOIA and say, you know, what are you
right.
doing? Didn't know that. Nonprofit, they don't have to answer. So consider that you have nonprofit entities operating on tax monies, but with no accountability from taxpayers. Some would say this is a sweetheart deal for the state when they want to forward dollars to certain activities they may not want to be accountable for those activities to the citizens who are paying for them. I recently met with a handful of lawmakers pitching an idea for legislation that would make nonprofit organizations that take in tax dollars for their operations subject to public records requests, subject to FOIA. Makes sense, right? Shouldn't citizens have full access to information about how their money is being spent and why? Of course. But, you know, you start mentioning that, you get all these First Amendment arguments. But that's a dynamite point, and it's a point we're going to pick up later in our podcast
right,
today.
And this gets very much into land use and sort of the abuse of environmental concerns. You hand out a bunch of money to not-for-profits, and the next thing you know, landowners are having real serious problems.
Right.
Right.
Or the public is going to get no transparency into what's going
right.
on.
Right.
And really, that's kind of our
and a
next
lot of
story.
Money and a lot of money wasted. A lot of money wasted.
Yeah.
It's a huge job program.
It's a lot. It really is it's up to and including sovereignty of
right.
the problem.
Right.
And we'll get this. Let's just cut to this next story. It involves NACs,
right.
Natural Asset Corporations, and we talked briefly about that last week. But I want to let's circle back because now there's a lawsuit. It's actually maybe a couple lawsuits, but here we go. This is a PDF right from Kansas and Utah, and what they're doing, they're writing to the SEC about the SEC's order. Okay, what the SEC is doing is they proposed order instituting proceedings to determine whether to approve or disapprove a rule change to amend the New York Stock Exchange listed companies manual to adopt listing standards for natural asset companies. And so these attorneys general are writing and saying, here's why you want to oppose this rule, SEC. This rule is way out of bounds. And so, you know, I do better with stuff printed out. So I'm just going to, I printed it out and went through it. And I'm going to just sort of.
I thought it was a fascinating letter. It's fascinating.
It is. To me, what's fascinating is it's the proposed rule is just flatly contrary to the law on multiple points.
Right.
And it's like, okay, what's
SEC
going on here?
SEC is way outside their lane.
Way outside. They are way far out of bounds, and it's not a little matter either. It's a huge matter.
Yes.
The other interesting thing is, we'll just cut to it. There's a couple interesting things, a lot. But I'm going to just read a few pages. This is from paragraph. This is from page 3. New York Stock Exchange proposes to add to its listed company manual a new subsection permitting, and they're quoting here, permitting the listing of common equity securities of natural asset companies. Okay, NACs. And the proposed rule defines NACs as, quote, corporations that hold the rights to the ecological performance of a defined area and have the authority to manage the areas for conservation, restoration, or sustainable management. Okay, and they say, Attorney General, this is coming from the Rockefeller Foundation, the Attorney General point out. So what's their basic argument? Their strongest two arguments are it's contrary to the federal land management use statute. That's a federal law. And it's contrary to the Securities Act, the Securities Exchange Act of 1934. Right. And specifically, they say under the FLPMA, the Federal Land Policy Management Act, that's federal law.
Mm-hmm.
That law mandates that manage public lands on the basis of multiple use and sustained yield. This means the agency must provide for a combination of uses that achieve and maintain high level annual or periodic output of the various renewable sources, end quote. What does the rule say? The proposed rule from the SEC on national asset companies directly contradicts it. Quote, once the BLM has issued a conservation lease, the BLM shall not authorize any other uses of these leased lands that are inconsistent with the authorized conservation uses. So they're basically saying don't use the land. Flatly contrary to what the law says. And
right.
that's the land management law and the securities law, the same kind of contradiction. The law says the central purpose of the 1934 Securities Act is, quote, to ensure the maintenance of fair and honest markets and securities transactions. Okay? The Supreme Court weighed in and said, okay, what does that mean? It means designed, quote, designed to protect investors against manipulation of stock prices. That's it. What does the proposed rule from the New York Stock Exchange say? And from the SEC, the commission openly admits that the purpose of the rule is to, quote, end the overconsumption and underinvestment in nature, end quote, through, quote, bringing natural assets into the financial mainstream. And here's where it gets interesting in terms of scope. It seeks to plug what it calls the SEC calls a $5 trillion plus financing gap for biodiversity and climate change by enabling NACs to list on the New York Stock Exchange and present the economic case for biodiversity. Again, squarely contrary to the act, so far beyond the scope of the Securities Act. It's not even funny.
Okay, let me talk a little bit about NACs, and then I want to talk about the problem the SEC has developed. One is, the Biden administration has signed on to a global initiative called 30 by 30. And that is that 30% of your land is then moved out of use into conservation in a variety of ways. So let's say the national parks are 12 to 14%. So we've got 12. And they're saying by 2030, we're going to move 30%. So we're going to take it up from the national parks to the state parks. We're going to double that and somehow move it into this protected category. But it gets better. Then the White House came out with a natural capital accounting strategy that I'm still trying to understand. But if I understand it correctly, what it says is we can reflect not only the value of the national parks and other land, including land and conservation easement. But we can mark it up to reflect its real value. Okay. So this is not a mark to market. This is a mark to
fantasy.
Right. Now, this is a great way to plug the collateral fraud in the global system, right?
Yep.
And to support the debt, because the central banks can print money and you can simply inflate the balance sheet forever, thus pushing everybody off the land. So if you look at how NACs could combine. Now, one of the things you see in the language of a variety of different initiatives, including coming from McKinsey in Davos, is harmonization of global standards and the ability to harmonize natural accounting and natural assets globally.
So that's what we need, yeah.
Right? No, it's really, and if you look at the verbiage, it's unbelievable, unbelievable pretzel talk. One of the leaders in warning people about 30 by 30 and the NACs is Margaret and Dan Byfield, who run American Stewards of Liberty. And we're having Margaret on the Financial Rebellion this week. So we'll publish it this week. But I'm getting deeply into this because if you look at what I think they're going to do with an NACs, and one of my prejudices, John, is I've dealt with a lot of federal contracting. And one of the things I know is you give a federal contract to certain kinds of companies, and then they do whatever they want. And that's fine with, that's hunky dory with the government. Right.
Yeah.
And so what they say they're going to do and then what they're free to do on those parks, you know, in the land. Now, here's the interesting thing. This includes being able to give rights to manage conservation easements on land which is privately owned. So you have tons of farmers and ranchers and landowners who've created conservation easements for a variety of reasons, which you're familiar with. And suddenly the NAC is in there and it's going to have authority over your easement.
Right.
So there are questions of private property and sovereignty here. And in a state that has a very high, you know, the Western states have a very big national park, very high percentage of their land. I think some huge percentage of Alaska is national parks.
Yeah, sure.
So, right. Sure. And so you have states with enormous percentages of their land, which is national or state parks. And you could end up with Lockheed Martin running everything.
Yeah, so unfortunately, Alaska is one of the people complaining, one of the states complaining.
Oh, absolutely. Tennessee's one of the ones who's, Tennessee's in this basket.
Yep. Yeah, no North
now,
Carolina.
Okay, so let me turn to the SEC. The SEC has consistently not only gone out of their lane, but refuse to provide basic services within their lane.
Right.
So they haven't stopped naked short selling. When FASB 56 came along, I don't know if you remember this, but when they sent FASB 56 around to the agencies, two of the most interesting comments going through the sort of comment process in the agency process, you know, you send it around and you get written comments. HUD said, oh, this is great. We need this. Now, why would the housing agency need to be, you know, need to be able to take their books dark? That's question number one.
Right.
But here is a provision when combined with the classification laws takes the entire U.S. government securities market secret and black. But if you add the banks and contractors who work for the government, get big government money, you take almost the whole securities market black, stocks and bonds, right?
Right.
The SEC, it comes around, it's now taking a huge portion of the U.S. securities market dark, and the SEC's comment is no comment.
Yeah.
So if their job is to protect investors and make sure they get adequate disclosure.
You should be in favor of transparency, not in favor of ledger domain.
Right. For the whole market, or 90% of the market. Now, so here we see them way outside their lane. And we see them, you know, not providing fundamental services, whether it's FASB 56 or naked short selling or on and on and on and on. Now, if I'm Gary Gensler and I'm looking at this many AGs saying, wait a minute, you're outside the lane. And I know I'm outside the lane in a number of different respects and not doing the fundamental things. Wouldn't you be nervous?
Not if I was compromised. I'd be less nervous than what would happen to me if I didn't go along, if I'm Gary Gensler.
Right.
Because everybody's in those positions because they're compromised. That's how the criminal syndicate works.
Right.
They got the goods on Gensler. They got the goods on everybody.
Right.
But to get back to what the NACs are and what the SEC is doing, the third argument, which it's really a more vague argument, is this violates the major question doctrine. You heard the figure $5 trillion from that little brief there. That's kind of the scope of this project. And the argument is when you can't have a proposed rule change and stuff a major question into a proposed little tweaking of the rules. And this is a major thing because it's $5 trillion by their own admission. So in other words, it's the SEC trying to Trojan horse in a massive legislative change in the form of a rule change. That violates the major question doctrine. That's kind of a third argument. I tend to favor the black letter document where you can just the black letter arguments where you can quote the law and quote what they're doing and see the patent contradiction between the two.
Right. But I think for public communication reasons, just pointing out that this is really bad policy is terrible. It's good marketing. So that's
great marketing.
I think the last section is just marketing. But, it seems to me that if you look at the extent to which NACs are going to compromise sovereignty and also compromise citizens, because remember, what you're doing is you're pumping up everybody's stock portfolio and their pensions in a way that pushes them off the land, if I'm right.
Yeah.
So it's...
Oh, for sure, that's coming. Yeah, absolutely.
You're using their pension funds to steal their real assets.
Yeah.
Okay. And this is why I say I'm not worried about the great taking of the securities market. This is a clear plan to use the securities market basically to steal everybody's real assets, right?
Exactly.
Right.
Right. You just saw it. You want a legal pathway? You just saw it.
Right. Exactly. If they're planning on doing $5 trillion of NACs.
Yeah.
They're not shutting the equity markets down yet.
Right. And they're proposing a whole accounting system where they can just,
Inflate.
It's just that the accounting system itself is just a nose of wax to be interpreted arbitrarily and capriciously by the criminals who are proposing the rule changes.
Okay, so let me ask you a question. Theoretical question, John. I know litigators don't like theoretical questions. Let's say we go ahead and we use the pension funds to buy $5 trillion of NACs that we are pumping up steadily with central bank pumping money injected in and financed with government debt. What's that going to do to property values? And therefore, what's that going to do to everybody's property taxes?
Oh, it's going to price you out. It's going to price you out of into oblivion.
Right.
Right.
Right. Yeah. This is really, just when I thought I had my full arms around the scope of all the worst, I discovered that NACs came with that. Well, anyway, we're going to be hearing a lot more about NACs all year long.
To be continued on NACs, yeah. Right. Yeah, we'll come back to that. Right now, let's get back to our favorite European punching bag, Davos, just to talk about how disconnected from reality these folks are. Swiss government priced out of Davos. World Economic Forum's annual summit has pushed accommodation costs beyond the reach of the federal government, local media reports. What's going on here? Swiss government can't afford to send its own officials to WEF's elite yearly get-together in Davos and is asking even higher level dignitaries, so cabinet level officials, to share hotel rooms. Blinken's got to bunk in with Yellen because they can't afford to get over there. Okay, so the WEF made 25 hotel rooms available to representatives of the Swiss government last year. 20 of those rooms were $1,472 a night, and five were $705 a night. Problem is, federal expense regulations only allow Swiss government officials to spend a maximum of $211. So they're out. They're priced out.
Yep.
You got to sleep in a tent, and it's cold. Right. Anyway, let's just be honest. The WEF. And Davos and all that's just an event for billionaire corporations.
So here was what was particularly scary. If you looked at that first chart you showed about, turbulent times, What those numbers showed is things that impacted them. In other words, it's turbulent if it's turbulent for them. If you look at the numbers, they're clearly not thinking in terms of what's turbulent for real people, you know, 2020, 21, 22, 23.
Right.
That shows an enormous disassociation.
Yes, it does.
Right.
Yes, it does. And it's interesting. Right. They expect way more turbulence as we're going forward.
Right. Because it's coming. It's busting through the bubble.
Oh, yeah. Right. It is. And so the censorship is coming. This is just going to do nothing but escalate for the next few years.
Right.
Okay, let's turn to crypto. Speaking of escalation, we'll see some escalation in the charts. You know, we said this was coming last week, and here it is. SEC approves spot Bitcoin ETFs. What that means for investors? Well, pray tell, what does it mean? The price of the largest cryptocurrency by market value climbed as high as almost $48,000 Tuesday evening after a tweet on the SEC suggested the regulatory agency approved a spot Bitcoin ETF. However, the SEC immediately issued a follow-up tweet that indicated its X page was hacked and that the tweet was fake. Well, that's really reassuring that the agency allowing the cryptocurrency is hacked. Boy, I'm not confident. Bitcoin prices quickly turned tail. So what do we got here? What's the reach of this? What's the scope? Spot Bitcoin ETFs will drive demand by investment advisors and wealth and private banking integrated products, as well as provide easier access to ETFs and direct broker accounts, says one expert or another. The analyst thinks that total managed crypto assets will reach $500 billion to $600 billion over the next 5 years, up from the current $45 to $50 billion. So they're 5 years, this analyst is saying, you're going to get a 10 bagger in 5 years.
Right.
Wow.
So he's saying Bitcoin goes to 400.
Yeah.
Right.
Yep.
Right. If that translates. But, you know, this means you can buy Bitcoin with a point and click, and you can also put you know, sell price. You can put stops on your position. So although that can be dangerous to do, and we can talk about that in another time. But, you know, as I said last week, this is going to be an IOU priced in Bitcoin. So there's already questions about BlackRock, whether they really have the, you know, the Bitcoin or not. And what's interesting, it really did price, you know, the old adage, price the rumor, you know, buy the rumor,
sell the news.
Yeah. And, you know, because it ran up way higher and then they approved it and it's back down.
That textbook case of buy the rumor, sell the news.
Right, but I think this gives them the ability to do a pump on Bitcoin during the election, which will be potentially very significant. So
agreed.
Yeah.
Agreed. The games have begun.
The games have begun. The games have begun. Yeah. And, you know, don't get tricked on this. So if you're going to trade it like a dangerous speculative market. Do not trade it like it's a real asset because it's not.
Yeah, just be careful.
Yep.
Okay, let's circle back. I meant to cover this earlier in FedWatch. It's our last story. It's a video. And it concerns Lloyd Austin, Secretary of Defense, and his disappearance for a few days. And then he resurfaced, supposedly released from Walter Reed Hospital, working from home. But here's the story. This story broke, I believe, on this is airing the 18th. I think this was the 16th this broke. Anyway, here we go. Maybe the 15th. But here's the story according to MSNBC.
Now to some breaking news on the health of Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin. Joining us now, NBC News senior White House correspondent Gabe Gutierrez. Gabe, good morning. What do we know?
Hi there, Jose. Good morning. Well, we just received word that Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin has been released from the hospital. We're just getting this statement just a few moments ago from the Secretary of Defense and as well from his doctors. And the Secretary says, I'm grateful for the excellent care that I received at Walter Reed National Military Medical Center. I want to thank the outstanding doctors. As I continue to recuperate and perform my duties from home, I'm eager to fully recover. Now, his doctors say that he was released, that his prostate cancer was treated early and effectively, and that his prognosis is excellent. He has no planned further treatment for his cancer other than some surveillance. So, Jose, of course, this comes after the defense secretary was hospitalized for about 2 weeks. He was diagnosed with prostate cancer in early December, but it has received a lot of criticism from not only not notifying the White House, but notifying the public. Late last week, President Biden said that it was a lapse in judgment for the defense secretary not to alert the White House of the diagnosis, but that he still has full confidence in the defense secretary. And Lloyd Austin, of course, oversaw those strikes in Yemen last week from his hospital bed. But again, Jose, the breaking news is just a short time ago, we received a statement from Lloyd Austin saying that he has been released from the hospital and plans to continue working from home.
Okay. Wow.
Story makes absolutely no sense.
A lot of problems with that story. One of the problems is you're telling me this. So this guy, high ranking military guy, was AWOL.
Right.
No explanation for why he was gone. Just he was AWOL. That's your story.
Right.
Do you have another one? Because that one sucks.
He was in the hospital for 2 weeks.
Now, that's another problem with the story is even in this segment, there's a lot of backfilling going on. And if you look at timelines that come from whatever, New York Times, Washington Post, there's a lot of backfilling going on in the timelines. They'll say like, well, the power passed to, you know, Kathleen so-and-so on January 2nd. It's like, well, did she know that at the time, or are you backfilling now on January 10th saying that's what happened? And he was saying here, like, well, you know, Lloyd Austin said this. It's like, well, did he say that?
Well, but here's the other thing. They release him from the hospital, but there's no picture of him leaving the hospital.
There's 6 seconds of that video that's arguably after the hospital, but you don't know.
Tell whether he leaves some car and gets in a helicopter or plane. You don't know.
It's implied, but they never come out. There's a lot of suggestion, a lot of innuendo. But here's what we know. Lloyd Austin has not gotten up live in front of a video and with a microphone and said, I'm out of the hospital now. That has not yet happened. All we're getting is these statements coming from the Pentagon.
So normally in a situation like this, you would have a picture of him leaving Walter Reed, you know, so you could see Walter Reed in the background, and you would have him say something, even if it's brief.
Brief. Thank you for the help, the wonderful doctors of Walter Reed.
Right.
You know, I'm glad to be back.
Right. Story makes no sense. The whole story makes no sense.
No, and I'm not going to take the time to parse through the timeline. But I've done hundreds of timelines before, and there's a lot of backfilling going on in these timelines.
Right.
Like, well, you say that now, but what's the contemporaneous evidence, like on January 2nd, that such and such happened, or that so-and-so knew this? You say that now, but that's just not, there's no evidence.
So here's the thing you see between Blinken and Yellen and Biden and now Austin. The last thing you see is a team, a group of people who are a team who are also running the country. You know, it's not. Yeah. There's no team of people here running the country.
You don't know. Right. Who's running? It's not Biden.
Somebody's running the country. But the cabinet is not a team, and they're clearly not together running the country.
Yeah. And that story, there's a story about what happened to Lloyd Austin, but that's not it. So, you know, there's something factually happened with Lloyd Austin.
Lloyd Austin has disappeared and no one knows why or where he is, really.
Right. What's going on? I mean, why not tell somebody about it?
If I had just finished for more than a year mandating a vaccination, which was killing my soldiers and driving my soldiers out of the military. And now Rasmussen said 53% of Americans think, you know, the vaccine is killing people. You know, I might want to disappear. I mean, think about it. This guy is the guy running Operation Warp Speed, which I presume is still going on. So he is the guy liable for murdering millions of Americans.
Libel is a civil term. It would be guilty, a criminal term.
Well, I think you're liable before God. So he's accountable one way or the other.
It's on him, right. He's accountable.
It's on him.
You know, you heard another example of backfilling in that segment from MSNBC where it's like, well, Lloyd Austin, of course, oversaw the strikes in Yemen from his hospital bed. It's like, I don't remember seeing that at the time. Really? That's your story? Okay. Anyway, that's it for FedWatch. Let's move on, speaking of DOD, and Farmageddon to Farmageddon. With the story from, I knew this guy looked familiar. This is from Aussie 17. And this is basically Japanese professors from Vaccine Study Group unveil, they talk about unprecedented side effects.
These guys are so brave. Get ready to be impressed.
They are. Right. Vaccine Issues Study Group convened a press conference to reveal the critical and worrisome findings of their initial six-month investigations into the side effects of vaccines. The results, as presented by a panel of esteemed medical experts, have been nothing short of alarming. And here's their lineup. Professor Emeritus Masanori Fukushima of Kyoto University is one, and he's like, a systematic review of literature has unveiled some shocking information, and he goes on. This is not his first rodeo on money markets.
Right.
We had a video of him. I went back and checked, and it was back, I think, in late 2022, where he is just giving them utter hell. Anyway, he's now got some other people with him, though. The press conference did not shy away from discussing the suppression. This is another interesting thing, the suppression of information. You know, Japanese doctors are trying hard, but they face various obstructions to getting the word out, says Professor Fukushima. And that's been the case everywhere. The censorship is just out of control. He's joined also, though, by Professor Yasufumi Murakami from Tokyo University of Science. Again, saying, you know, you got all these sort of problems with messenger-type vaccines. It's unprecedented in human history for a single vaccine to have this much literature out on it. It doesn't know where to go. It gets into the bloodstream. It goes into the brain, liver, and kidneys. It's just a mess. Anyway, these guys are raising the hell, which is
right.
That's a very un-Japanese thing to do.
Right. And the last time we saw them in the first clip, we showed on Money and Markets, they were behaving in very un-Japanese ways. And it's funny, they remind me very much of the Doctors for COVID Ethics. You have these very highly credentialed, extremely prestigious doctors and scientists who are used to being honored as the creme de la creme, you know, awards, all sorts of stuff, you know, the leader in their field. Right. And they're highly confident that this is a killer. And they're outraged and they are amazed they can't punch through despite their credentials.
Right.
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 And that's when they come to grips with how evil this is.
Yeah. You know, I worked with a lot of witnesses over the years, including a lot of Japanese witnesses. And they are extremely careful with what they say, extremely careful to stick to the truth and, you know, try to do what's right. Very, very careful witnesses. I mean, it's almost like pulling teeth to get information out of them sometimes.
Right.
Almost afraid, like they don't want to step on toes. They don't want to rock the boat. So to see these professors come out like this, kind of with the gloves off, it's just like, whoa, this must be really bad, whatever they're talking about. And they're talking about the vaccine.
Right. Well, they're saying it's got to stop immediately.
Yeah.
Right.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Let's keep it going on Farmageddon from the Bangkok Post. So from one part of Asia to another, long COVID and vaccines may cause disease and death. Chula and Rangsit. I think these are two universities. Long COVID-19 infections and multiple COVID-19 vaccinations might let hidden diseases surface, weaken immunity, and lead to cancer and brain disorders, according to authorities from Chula and Rangsit universities. Yeah. Two professors said there were efforts to conceal data. So again, back to the concealment theme. There are efforts to conceal data about the people affected and killed by vaccinations. And the official number of people affected by vaccinations was thus unrealistically low. So the suppression campaign, the censorship campaign, means that estimates you get are too low. They also said that the mortality rate of Thais rose from its level before and during the COVID-19 pandemic. They urged for investigation to find out if it was related to vaccinations. They did not give relevant numbers. Anyway.
So Sutrad Bhakti sent this to me. He's Thai, and his son practices in Thailand. He sent it to me, and he said, it's going mainstream. And so this was clear indication from him that this
the Bangkok coast, yeah.
Yeah, this is a very mainstream presentation saying, okay, vaccine's killing people, you know. So, what we're seeing is it's popping out everywhere, and it's popping out because you have people with very strong scientific and medical credentials saying, you know, we're not backing down on this.
That's, you know, you're right. It is popping out. So it's two different places in Asia, Japan,
right,
and Bangkok, and it's two different. It's one's a press conference of university professors, and another's a Bangkok Post. I mean, it's a pretty major publication.
Yes. I mean,
when I put this together, like, I try to get the links that don't have pop-up ads and stuff like that. And sometimes, you know, I use a Web Archive. And this was, I didn't use Web Archive. I used 12-foot IO. But anyway, it's Bangkok Post is a pretty major publication, I think.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And Bhakti says, Bhakti's word is gold as far as I'm concerned.
Yep. Yep.
So, yeah, word's getting out.
Yep.
Word is definitely getting out. Okay, let's keep it going. Another finding from Igor's newsletter.
This is unbelievable. I love this guy's Substack. I read him all the time.
Yeah, it's, you know, I would appear to be pretty popular. COVID vaccines cause autism in lab rats, study finds. So what do we do? Giving pregnant rats Pfizer COVID vaccine induced autism-like traits in male pups male pups born after such vaccination. It was a placebo-controlled study published in Neurochemical Research. Again, you know, I don't think that's a small-time publication. I think it's pretty big. The standard rat tests here. I think there's another finding I wanted to point to in this. Nah, maybe not. Or either that or the highlighting disappeared. But that's, so it's in other words, a finding of rat studies. And Igor points out, he says, yeah, you should have been done these tests and these experiments before you jabbed a billion people full of this poison.
Before COVID started, if you looked at Brian Hooker and some of the work that CHD has done on autism, vaccines and autism, you clearly get the feeling that the boys are targeted, that there's something going on that is making it worse on the boys. So it's not new to see this.
Yeah, there's a different reason to target men and women.
Right.
You know, when you want to control a population, you target women because if you targeted men and you miss a few, you might as well have missed every single one of them. They repopulate freely.
Right.
You go after the women to control population. If you're going after men, it's to cut into the military. It's to cut into your muscle.
Right. Right.
Right. Your landmass army muscle.
Well, but remember, you're trying to protect, you're trying to stand down the people who protect the women and the family.
You got it.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's two different objectives, but that's interesting. They're talking to males.
Right. It looks to me like it's been that for a long way.
Well, it's not like we haven't read multiple times and multiple stories in Money and Markets over the years now.
Right.
Of the adverse effects on women.
Right.
Right? I mean, this is an equal opportunity killer. It's just the manifestations
Absolutely.
Are different.
Right. Right. So it looks to me, you know, we don't know about men, but it really does look like the COVID injections really harm female fertility.
For sure. And that's what you're after if you're going with females. It's
exactly.
reproduction. Right. Yeah. Okay. Let's keep it going. Farmageddon. The hits keep coming. You know, right back to the story at the top.
Pushback. Here we go.
Well, it's more here, more censorship. Ryan Cole, MD, you know, the board restricts. This is from Merrill Ness. Board restricts doctor's license over COVID misinfo. There you go. Misinfo, just like Google said. Okay. So what's going on here? the board has prevented him from engaging in the practice of primary care medicine and prescribing medications for patients, limiting his practice of medicine in the state to pathology, which I think is what he is. But what did he do wrong? Well, the commission found that Cole engaged in multiple acts of dishonesty when he made numerous demonstrably false and or misleading statements and presentations. There you go. Regarding the COVID-19 pandemic, COVID-19 vaccines, the use of ivermectin to treat COVID-19, and the effectiveness of masks. So he was given presentations.
Right. This has nothing to do with this treatment of patients or practice of pathology in the state.
Yeah. He's like, Listen, I'm a doctor. Patients I treated never suffered any harm. The presentations are not the practice of medicine.
Right. So they don't have jurisdiction. They don't have jurisdiction. They do not have jurisdiction.
Right. I mean, I don't know what the rules are over there with jurisdiction, but you know, you can see clearly it's not the practice of medicine that they're worried about his opinions. His public opinion is what he's being punished for.
Well, but this is a pattern we're seeing all across governmental agencies and these related boards like medical boards. Everybody's outside their lane.
Yeah.
Everybody's outside their lane.
Way outside.
And then nobody's doing what they're supposed to do in their lane. So they're not. And this is why I'm telling you it's going to come back to taxation. Because at some point you cannot pay millions of people to go outside their lane and make crazy and destroy the economy. Can't do it. It's not economic.
Right. It's not economic. Exactly.
It's not economic. Right.
Exactly. Okay. Let's go to the last story in Farmageddon. This next one is just unbelievable. The audacity of Pfizer. How about this? Pfizer makes big bet on looming heart failure pandemic. So you caused a heart failure. And now what do? You profit from it. Pfizer, the company, has bought for $6.7 billion in cash. It has acquired Arena Pharmaceuticals, a firm specializing in developing treatments, particularly for heart inflammation conditions like, how about it? The very things that are caused by the injection, myocarditis and pericarditis.
You know, I should have gone out and got that old video of W.C. Fields talking about how he was selling snake oil potion, you know, to deal with the snake that he just carried with him.
Yeah. That's incredible. I knew a guy, a Mexican gangster in Chicago, named Ruben. And I said, what was your first, your first racket? What did you do? He goes, counselor. That's what he called me, counselor. He goes, I was 5 or 6 years old, and the fire department was giving rewards for people who reported fires. So I would start fires and then phone them in.
Right.
They were on to me pretty fast. That's Pfizer.
Now, you know, it's interesting because their stock keeps, you know, sucking wind. And I just think investors anticipate they're going to be one of the chew toys.
Yeah.
How can they not be one of the chew toys here?
Yeah, right. I don't know. That's a really good question.
Even Lloyd Austin can't protect them now. You know, it's interesting because you almost wonder if Pfizer didn't have Lloyd Austin taken out someplace.
Well, you know, here's my question with Lloyd Austin. What's the over-under a date when he's in front of a microphone again? If I set the date as Valentine's Day for when he's going to first appear in front of a microphone in public again, would you take the over or the under on that?
I don't know if he's ever going to appear again.
So you take the over.
Yeah.
So you'd in other words, if he doesn't show up by February 14th, you collect on the over bet. I don't know.
Here's the thing. I don't know because, you know, usually in a situation, there are patterns where you can make an intelligent guess. If you look at what's going on here, there's so many different things going on related to DOD. And there's so little information, it's impossible to make an intelligent guess.
There's a ton of misinformation. There's a blizzard of misinformation in the Lloyd Austin story.
Right.
a blizzard of like backfilling and, you know, who knew what when and what do we know and what don't we know? And where's Lloyd? Where is he?
Right.
You know, I don't know. We'll see. Okay. But let's keep it going. Let's get into the topic du jour, which is pushback. And let's start with another lawsuit about with the WHO.
Right.
Okay. So this is
an emergency. This is really, to me, this is about emergency power and the use of emergency power.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Exactly. But let's skip down. There's familiar culprits in this one. This is a federal case in the Northern District of Texas, Fort Worth, Texas and Oklahoma versus the Department of Health and Human Services. Complaint for declaratory and injunctive relief. What are we talking about here? This paragraph 2. They don't waste any time on this one, do they? Department's definition, meaning the Department of Health and Human Services, and 42 CFR 670.1 exceeds the agency's authority because it unlawfully delegates to the WHO the authority to invoke emergency health powers in the U.S., infringing on U.S. and state sovereignty. Can't do that, says these guys. Let's get down to paragraph 14, see what they got. How did this come about? Well, one day before President Barack Obama, oh, there's a familiar name, President Obama, second term expired. So one day before he's out of office for good, HHS promulgated a rule defining the term public health emergency. It provided 5 definitions for the term. Okay. So the first definition is fine. Second one's fine. But then we get into trouble. The final 3 definitions rely solely on information from and determinations by the WHO. Public health emergency, according to the WHO, is, and then you get these long definitions that are sort of vague. They declare emergency whenever. And this is what's interesting, too. In 2017, so this was done sort of like the SEC's proposed rule. They put the proposed rule out to give people time to comment, and people comment, and they raise objections, and objections were raised here, and here's what the WHO said. Get this. 2017, when responding to public comments criticizing this approach as a breach of United States sovereignty, HHS Health and Human Services argued that it would not actually use the definitions 3, 4, and 5 of public health emergency.
Wow.
So did it just cross them out and say, well, we'll just delete them for the statute? No, they left them in. And the lawsuit says, well, if you left them in, then they're still in.
Right.
And so that's basically the lawsuit.
Right. So it's interesting. The state, which from what I can tell, has one of the best records protecting citizens against the pandemic is Oklahoma. So it's interesting that we see Oklahoma with Ken Paxton, who had to fight off an incredible impeachment charge to stay Attorney General of Texas. And you can see why somebody might want to get rid of him.
Yeah, right.
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 You could see that. Yeah. But that's a solid lawsuit. So if you want to kind of understand what the kerfuffle is and what the objection to the WHO is, that complaint, you know, they don't waste any time getting out of brass tacks.
The whole pandemic comes down to abuse of emergency powers.
Oh, totally.
Totally. Right.
Totally. Yeah, the emergency power, that term, emergency power, emergency authority, that's a massive Trojan horse for big problems.
Right. And I'll tell you what the big problem is when you look at something like NAAQS and natural accounting. You have to presume that the people who are going to be engineering it, making money on it, and running it have the same abuse of power tendencies as the people who did the pandemic. Right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Right. So you can't assume good faith, right?
No.
Right.
Yeah. Anyway, let's keep it going with pushback. This next one's just, I love this because this is like, you know what? What can I do? You know, what do I have in this? Ban facial recognition in stores. Okay. Let's just get right into it. Store scorecard. Excellent. What are we talking about? Walmart. They are using facial recognition. Okay. So we can scotch that one. Kroger. I shop at Kroger occasionally, won't use it. Great. Walgreens, so they have a list. There's your scorecard.
Yeah.
Target won't use Lowe's. I mean, here's the one that hurt me was one of my stores I go to, and I'm going to have to write to them, I guess. Dillard's. I shop at Dillard's. damn it, they might use it. So I lock, you know, so I'll email.
Tell them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, so there you go. Scorecard, right. Very handy dandy scorecard.
That was very handy. That was very handy. Yeah.
And some surprises on there.
Right.
And, you know, like good for them.
Yeah. Don't be afraid to, you know, walk into Walmart to customer service and say, I'm not coming back because you've got facial recognition. What do you think
you're
doing?
Right? Yeah. Right. You can recognize my face walking out the door forever.
Right.
Right. That's you're going to recognize me. Okay. Right. Let's keep it in pushback. Keep it going from yet another quarter from juries and your neck of the woods, too.
Yeah.
Philadelphia jury awards $3.5 million in Roundup lawsuit against Bayer. This is really interesting. I want to just cut right to what is so fascinating about this. After losing early Roundup lawsuits, Bayer won 9 consecutive lawsuits and settled several others for undisclosed amounts. But then the company's winning streak hit a wall in October of 2023 when it lost 5 trials in as many weeks. Since Bayer acquired Roundup, manufacturer Monsanto, in 2018, its market cap has fallen to $33 billion, less than half of what it paid for Monsanto. So Bayer is a big loser in this. Mounting legal costs have haunted the company since the merger. That's got to be chilling if you're a Bayer executive.
Right.
You got a bad problem since October 2023. Interesting.
And this was not a large amount. So 3.5 million is not a large amount in the scheme of what they're litigating. But it's part of the momentum. And the momentum is clearly going against Bayer.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. And it's right. And it's since October. So, right. Again, it's consistent with our theme, you know, really from the beginning of the year. You're seeing way more pushback now.
Yes.
And that is why the censorship is really going to step up.
Right. Right. But a jury, you know, if you're a jury and you want to push back against, you know, the centralizers, this is, you get on a jury like this and now you have a shot. You have a chance.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Right.
Right.
Okay, let's turn back to NACS and pushback. We saw the pushback in another story, FedWatch, from the state attorneys general. That's not the only quarter pushback's coming from. Get this. This is the House Committee on Natural Resources. Chairman Bruce Westerman, anyway, a press release. Members initiate probe into SEC's rule change permitting foreign agents and radical activists to control America's national parks and lands. And here's what they say. The committee. This is right from Congress. The proposed rule would allow private investment interests to control and manage national parks and other publicly owned lands, an unprecedented power grab and usurpation of federal authority. The proposal designates unsustainable activities as activities that cause any material adverse events without defining what qualifies as a material adverse impact. Thus, this crucial determination is seemingly outsourced to IEG, a private company with its own interests and shareholders to answer to. Who is IEG? Well, the concept of NACS was developed by Intrinsic Exchange Group, a private company incorporated in Delaware. The New York Stock Exchange has acquired a minority stake in IEG and has a seat on the board of directors. Wonderful.
Little conflict of interest, do we think?
They're in bed together.
Right.
But more specifically, other investors in IEG include Inter-American Development Bank and, ta-da, the Rockefeller Foundation.
Right.
That's an interesting charge coming from Congress. It's like it's mainstream now, almost, to say, you know, you're in bed with the Rockefellers. Right?
That's why I'm optimistic, because, you know, I started trying to do something in 91. Well, I started in 89, and, you know, it's been going ever since. But finally, I think enough people have figured out, okay, we got to do something.
When you start seeing congressional quarters complaining about you're in bed with the Rockefellers, you've witnessed a sea change of public opinion in the U.S.
No, and sure. I'll tell you why I don't agree with that. Because they continue to use J.P. Morgan Chase as their lead U.S. government depository, even though $21 trillion is missing from accounts. Yeah.
You start seeing Rockefeller there? Jamie Dimon's on the menu. He just slowed her down.
Jamie Dimon should be on the menu.
Yeah.
Yeah. But make no mistake about it. They control the most government, federal and state deposits in the country.
Oh, yeah.
JP Morgan Chase and Citibank are the two biggest in the New York Fed, and their reach in terms of controlling. Talk to a state treasurer. See where his money is. It's up at JP Morgan Chase because they offer bigger interest because, after all, they can just print money, right?
I know. Fortress balance sheet. Fortress balance sheet. we had to take that TARP money. That was forced on us.
Yeah. So
even though we borrowed even more money the very next day.
If you look at all these different businesses and individuals and institutions, I dare say a lot of people listening to this Money in Markets bank or have a credit card from JP Morgan Chase.
Okay? Fortress balance sheet.
Why? If they ran Madoff and Epstein and, why would you want them to have access to your data and your deposits? And why would you want to but we have the ability to walk away.
Yeah.
Right.
Right. Okay.
we're coming up to my favorite story of the week. This is
my
favorite.
Yet. We're not there yet.
We're close.
More sea change. Here we go. Right. More than half. This is from Rasmussen, okay?
Right.
This is not some fringe. This is Rasmussen, major.
Right.
More than half of the countries suspect COVID-19 vaccines have caused deaths, okay? The latest Rasmussen reports, National Telephone, an online survey, finds that 53% of American adults believe it is likely that side effects of COVID vaccines have caused a significant number of unexplained deaths. Now, this is interesting, okay? 53%. Okay, so there's two kind of elements here. It's likely that side effects have caused a significant number of unexplained deaths, okay? So that includes 30% who think it's very likely. 36% now say they don't know a significant... 36% now don't say a significant number of deaths have been caused by vaccine side effects, including 16% who believe it's not at all likely. That's not a very big number. In other words, only 16% of the country thinks it's unlikely that it's a significant number. The new findings come as Georgia Republican Marjorie Taylor Greene holds hearing today on COVID-19 vaccine safety with witnesses Dr. Peter McCullough, Dr. Ryan Cole, and Dr. Kurt. So here you go. Here's the originals.
Yeah. Right.
You can't give those opinions. Take your license. 54% of Americans believe there are legitimate reasons to be concerned about the safety of COVID vaccines, while 33% think people who worry about vaccine safety are spreading conspiracy theories. So you now know that 13% of the population reads mainstream sources and believes them.
33.
The rest of them do not.
Right.
Right.
Right. And it's amazing. I don't know if you listened to that interview we did 2 weeks ago on the process of how propaganda gets integrated into people's worldview. But it's extraordinary to think that the 33% would think that harm from the COVID injections was a conspiracy theory.
That's just breathtaking.
Right. Because there's an overwhelming amount of scientific evidence from multiple sources, including the top professors in Japan. It's just unbelievable. Anyway.
Yeah. Conspiracy. The term conspiracy theory means you don't have time or energy or whatever to combat the thing on the merits. So you're going to try to dismiss it with it.
Okay. So let me ask you a trick question. How many of those 33%? As doctors, healthcare givers, administrators, or other jobs made money from pushing the COVID pandemic and injections?
Are you saying of the people who think it's misinformation or whatever, a conspiracy theory, who are doctors,
so
what percentage made money on it?
What percentage of those 33% made money from the pandemic or were part of an organization that made money for the pandemic? Are they saying that because they were the pushers and made money from it, or because they really believe?
There's not that many doctors. I mean, there's a million lawyers in the U.S. I'd probably say no more doctors. It's not a huge number. I don't think it's a big number.
I'll bet you more than half of that 33%.
Although the healthcare sector is a big, it's
huge.
One of the biggest employers in the U.S.
Right. So, in many counties, it's 30% or more.
But so, I don't, the healthcare worker, are they making money from peddling injections? Probably not.
Yeah. Peddling all the different parts of the pandemic that the federal government paid people for. So, it could have been the injections, but it could also be the different restrictions that were put on hospitals.
The hospitals did make, they get a lot of money for different,
right,
classified as COVID. You get more money if they died, right?
Right. But I think a lot of those 33% are financially invested in the official narrative.
Yeah, I wouldn't hang my hat on that.
Mm, okay.
I don't need to.
You don't need to
stick. Yeah. I don't need to stick my neck out like that. And I'm not gonna.
Right. No. Yeah. You're always. You're a litigator. I'm an investment banker. Remember, we can't wait for the facts to trade.
not touching that one.
Okay. Nope. Okay.
Okay. Now to your favorite story.
Yes, this is my favorite story of the week.
It's just hilarious. Hertz begins dumping 20,000 electric vehicles and shift back to gas cars. In 2021, Hertz tapped Tom Brady to promote its massive push to electrify its fleet. But now, two plus years later, October, when Hertz chief executive Stephen Scherr told investors on a third quarter earnings call that the company would start reducing its electric vehicle fleet because of high repair costs compared to the rest of the fleet, which has hurt his bottom line. EVs, he says, will be slower than our prior expectations. Hertz began dumping 20,000 electric vehicles on the used car market last month and will be a seller throughout 2024. What are we talking about in terms of Hertz's business? Electric vehicles were about 11% of 11% and falling of Hertz's total fleet. Wow.
Wow. Wow.
You know, Hertz is one of those huge corporations. They didn't go along with the corporate memo. They're not going along with the corporate memo.
Well, here's the interesting thing, because I said to you this yesterday, when the Japanese professors come out, that's not something that can spread virally, that can rocket virally, because, you know, each university, each professor knows that's going to come at a cost.
Right.
But what Hertz is saying, you know, we don't have time for the climate change. Yeah, yeah. It's not economic. It's not working on the ground. It's not,
right,
you know, because we can't afford to lose money on this. So we're dumping it and walking. And every business associated with these things is going to take note and they're going to act too.
Yeah.
This is going to spread virally because it has to. You can't just lose money for no reason.
It's interesting. We'll see in some charts why Hertz. This is a smart move by Hertz.
Yes, it is.
That's apparent from some very interesting charts.
Right.
We'll see where those charts are from. But anyway, speaking of charts, let's get into the charts.
Okay.
And we'll start with the wallpaper chart. You know the wallpaper chart?
Yeah, the wallpaper chart. Finviz.
Fit this. It's the wallpaper. Here you go. Here's your wallpaper. It looks the same as it did last time. This is 1 year. VIX at the very bottom.
Right.
How many months has that been the case?
And on how many times have we seen orange shoes at the top?
At the top. It's wallpaper, I swear. Justin, are you getting... He's not really... He just keeps copying the same chart, I'm convinced.
No.
But that...
No.
I'm joking. But it is. It's the same chart week in and week out. However, what's interesting is when you go to year to date, the wallpaper is gone. And now we see VIX in the middle.
Right. Shocking. And interest rates soften. And look at what is happening to the commodities, which are part of every household's essential goods.
Yeah, this is...
You know, interest rates really clock many of these commodities, but interest rates are falling, and look at what's happening.
It really did, but you still see the natural stuff, you know.
Right.
Look at all these. I mean, the first kind of non-natural appearance in that list at the top is the U.S. dollar.
Right.
everything else, I mean, that's kind of a tell right there. Look at this stuff. It's all up over the dollar.
Yep.
Cocoa, sugar, natural gas, lean hogs, cattle, feeder. I mean, that's remarkable.
All of those were moving up strongly, and then the higher interest rates came, they all got whacked, and I kept saying, you know, Powell's strategy is working, but...
Gold,
right?
Bond,
right?
Silver, Japanese yen, the standard safety plays, not doing so well.
Right.
Anyway, okay, let's keep it going in charts. U.S. dollar index, what do we have here?
Very strong.
Year to date.
Right.
Yep. Look at that.
I keep getting buried with, you know, messages saying the dollar is going to collapse shortly, and... Is it 103 this morning? So it's above 103.
That is a very cleverly disguised collapse in that chart, right. I must say.
Right.
No.
Well, if you look at the market share, you know, the trade in oil is, you know, significant trade has moved away from the dollar. So 20% of oil trade last year was non-dollar. But if you look at the market share and reserves, it's falling steadily, but slowly. And if you look at its trade in other sort of aspects of trade and markets, it's not falling, or tiny amounts.
Tiny amounts.
The dollar is dangerous and dominant.
It is.
It is.
It is for sure. Okay, right. Let's turn to another chart. This is 1 month Bitcoin chart.
Yeah. So we said
3,000.
Yeah, we said buy the rumor, sell the news, and here it is.
There you go.
Yeah.
So that approval takes place. This is the rumor phase, right? Like, oh, spot Bitcoin ETF is coming,
right.
And then you get it. It's like, well, sell the news. Yep.
Now, I think they can play tremendous games pulling the country apart using Bitcoin and gold, and we're not going to talk about it today, but that's why one of the reasons I expect such a big pump on Bitcoin and gold, too.
I think you're right.
Right.
You expect a pump on gold.
Yep. Yep. Not, you know, Bitcoin's going to be used to...
Wow.
Pull lots of money out of gold, but they want all the states doing bullion depositories and buying gold. So so there's going to be a lot of demand from the central banks and now from the states for gold as basic part of their reserves.
Mm. Wow.
Right.
Interesting. Bold, too. So we'll see. That's an interesting prediction.
Well, here's but the thing. Think of it this way. I print trillions of dollars with fiat currency, right?
Yeah.
And I debt base it. And I attribute the liability of the debt to you. But I get the... So I create $34 trillion. I take the $34 trillion. I got the $34 trillion. Now you owe $34 trillion. You're in debt, but you don't have the $34 trillion. I got the $34 trillion, right? Okay. Now you say we're going to switch from the dollar because fiat is bad to a currency that is limited in amount that I now control most of. Okay?
Yeah.
So I own the biggest positions in Bitcoin and I own the biggest positions in gold. So now we switch to that and I've got the gold, I've got the Bitcoin, and I've got the cash, and you've got the debt, right? So now I use gold and Bitcoin or, you know, to limit the extent to which anything can be debased or diluted. And I've got you in a deflationary trap.
There's a couple of tricky parts about that. One is you don't have the gold.
Yeah, I do. I do. I control a lot of gold.
If you're the Fed?
If you're the Fed and you're the central banks, if you're the global central banks, yeah.
I query how much they have in their possession.
Oh, I think they have a lot in their possession.
Could be. Had been a while. Yeah. Been since 1952, since an audit.
Well, one of the big questions is how much gold do you have at GLD, you know, and in the trading vehicles? Big question. Nobody knows.
Yeah, you know, right. You got a lot of paper to jam Jimmy the price down, as far as I can tell.
Right, but here's the thing. The you know, this comes because people think the problem is fiat currency. The problem is not fiat currency. The problem is the debt basing. The other problem is the system's not having any integrity. Those are your two problems.
That's a huge problem, right?
It's a huge problem.
The other problem is when you talk about a liability in the Fed's balance sheet, it's there really aren't liabilities on the Fed's balance sheet. A liability, when a bank says depositor liability, what they mean is the reason your $100 deposit is a liability is the bank customer can say, hey, I want that in cash.
Right. Right.
And the bank doesn't print cash. The Fed prints cash. The bank's got to come up with something that it doesn't make.
Right.
The Fed is no longer in that position and hasn't been in that position since 1971. When you say, hey, I've got $100 of reserves, I want to redeem that, and you're a bank, you know what you're going to get back?
Right.
You're going to get $100 bills.
So why does Augustine Carson's describe it as an expression of central bank liability? Since the central bank can just print money.
Right. It's been able to do that for over 50 years.
Right.
It's not really a liability.
Right. I get it.
They like that term, though, because it's not money. And the U.S. Constitution says Congress got control over the money. So they don't want, they're careful to stay away from the term money.
Right. That's true.
Right. That's a hot wire. That's
so I come back to the same old question. If you were Powell, how are you going to get authorizing legislation to do what you want to do?
They'll find a way. I mean, I wait with bated breath, but rest assured they're going to do that. They'll probably honestly, a huge emergency or world war be a way.
Mm-hmm.
They'll Trojan horse something in under some massive conflict.
Right, it's the Patriot Act. They'll do the Patriot Act
on steroids.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's coming. Okay, let's turn back to charts. 10-year Treasury. This is interesting.
Yeah, so rates coming down, and we saw it finally go through 4. So it's down. It went through 4, then it came back up, then it's down again through 4. And so this is a real softening. And looking at those commodity inflation prices, you wonder if this is going to stick. You know, we'll if you look at the Fed number, and we looked at the Fed numbers, I think last week or the week before. You know, they're saying this year it's going to be 4%, and that's where it is now. Question is, can they really? I think Powell will do whatever he has to do to defend the dollar globally, and that could mean we're going to see, you know, we're going to go back where we were, even higher. So be prepared for that scenario. Don't bet the wrench that we stay at 4.
I would agree with that. Yep. He's going to do whatever he's got to do to defend the dollar.
Right.
Okay. And now the 30-year Treasury, kind of the same graph, really.
Yeah. So a little bit of upward sloping.
Yeah. More recently. Okay. Next up, safety trade. Look at this year to date.
Yeah. So S&P, you know, it looks like it did last year. S&P is, you know, is up for the beginning of the year. GLD and the 20-year Treasury ETF and emerging markets down. So, you know, those kind of relate. And here's what's interesting with the dollars, you know, part of the EEM going down is the dollar strong. But you would think with lower interest rates, there'd be more wind in their sails, but there's not.
Yeah.
Yep.
This is early, but out of the gate, yeah, not looking so good for the safety trade.
Right.
Okay. Next up. Here we go. Let's get into why Hertz is right.
Right.
This is kind of my read. This is sort of a quick thumbnail read on why Hertz knows what it's doing. This is from Statista, plug-in electric vehicle sales worldwide, 2021, 2022. But that's a huge amount of sales because it's really ramped up in those years. Okay, so here if you look at North America, you could see that it's basically 1.7, 1.8 million vehicles in North America. So if you add in the previous years and then you back out the Canadian and non-North America parts, you could say roughly you probably got around 2 million electrical vehicles in the U.S.
Right.
Back of the napkin. That's about what it is. Okay. Okay. So let's look next at how do you fill these vehicles up with energy? Number of public electric vehicle chargers in 2022 by major country and type. I just want to zoom into this. The United States has 100,000 slow chargers and 28,000 fast chargers. So again, back of the napkin, if you talk 2 million vehicles divided by 128,000 chargers, and notice it's chargers. It's not charging stations. It's chargers.
Okay? Right.
You got about 15 to 16 vehicles per charger. That's a lot, because what Status is not telling you is it takes about an hour to over 8 hours to charge these things up.
Right.
So if you've got 16 chargers and the average American is filling up or charging their vehicle every 4 to 5 days, odds are real good you roll up to a charger and you're going to be waiting a while.
Right. And that's what the story we told about the, it was the Secretary of Transportation, right, who got in a huge mess trying to travel the country in an electric car.
Yeah. So. Right. And so with that background, I want to turn to the last sort of thumbnail sketch of why Hertz is right, the last chart from Statista, and it's this. Leading reasons inhibiting the purchase of EVs, according to consumers worldwide as of March 2022. Look at these. Lack of charging stations. Range anxiety. Absence of adequate homework charging infrastructure. Those are the biggies. People don't want to get stuck in a car where they can't get anywhere and can't charge it up, or they got to take a ton of time to do it.
This was a very interesting study by Statista, but two of the things I found very interesting was one of the things they said is the biggest reason people bought electric cars were environmental concerns. They were thinking what they were doing was good for the environment. Now, if you really dig in and look at the engineering and the economics and the
right,
the use of materials, electric cars are not good for the environment. They're great for a central control model, but they're not great for the environment.
No.
And so as people realize that you know, that's a bunch of, you know, it's just more pretzel talk, who's going to buy an electric car? The other thing I wanted to bring up, I took a look at some of the market share on these companies. And once again, we've talked about this last year. You know, you have a lot of big car companies who've spent a lot of time and money trying to do electric cars. Of course, the biggest company is China, BYD from China. If you look at BYD, by far and away, the biggest producer of electric cars, they have a market cap of $79 billion. Tesla's market cap is $700 billion. To compare,
wow.
General Motors' market cap is now, let me see, $48 billion, right?
Wait a minute. So
Tesla is worth, you know, so it's 14 times the value of General Motors. So Tesla is trading at a P.E. Wait, this gets better. Tesla is trading at a P.E. of 71 times. General Motors is trading at a P.E. of 5 times. And Volkswagen is trading at a 3.9 times. So Volkswagen's market share is $57 billion. They have an 8% yield. So you can get an 8% yield
right,
investing in Volkswagen.
Wow. That's a layup. That's, I mean, I want to know what GM's and Volkswagen's price to book is. I mean, it's probably going to be around one. I mean, those numbers.
No. Their PE is...
price to book.
Oh, price to book. I didn't look at price to book.
Yeah. Price to earnings is
right,
low. It's absurdly
right,
low, 8 and 3.
Right.
That's shocking. That's absolutely shocking.
Yeah, but I think we showed the chart where you take all the other big car companies and Tesla's market share is bigger than all of them together.
That's ludicrous.
It's completely ludicrous.
I go back to, there's 3 comic book manufacturers in the U.S.
Right.
And Elon Musk is the CIA comic book character. And people believe it.
But I think they're trying to make it, you know, his job on Tesla is to make electric cars fashionable. Because they're so important to the control grid, right?
He's doing a magnificent job.
Right. So he's doing electric vehicles. He's doing satellites. He's doing mesh networks in the back of your head to hook you up to his satellites, and then he's doing Twitter.
That's a great point.
He's making
man.
The control grid fashionable.
Electric vehicles, Starlink, and Twitter.
Right, and it's all designed for control. He's making it fashionable. So I think whoever is, you know, pumping in. If you can print money, you can print enough money to, you know, pump Tesla up to $700 billion, right?
Yeah, well, you know, the theme should have been Superman meet Mr. Musk. Oh, that's unbelievable. That's insane, those numbers you just read. Anyway, that's great.
It's a joke.
It is a joke. Okay.
Well, here's the thing, you know, because get ready. You know, one of the challenges of Operation Pushback is we're gonna be very unpopular this year in certain respects, and the two respects.
What does that mean? What do you mean?
Okay, so my latest dialogue on the Salieri Report, Dick, this keeps happening, is someone saying it's not Operation Warp Speed is not Trump's fault, you know, he was tricked by Fauci.
Yeah.
And I said, President Trump authorized the spending of $10 billion through the military, overriding all laws, knowing that it takes, you know, 12 years to safety test a vaccine. So he put a head of brain machine interface in charge, and he poisoned millions of America. Now, if you're telling me he's too stupid not to know what he did, then he's not smart enough to be president. But, you know, I think he's smart enough to know what he did. So I think mass atrocity is not something you reelect a person, you know, as a result of. Okay. Now, if you look at what just happened.
Well, wait. What does that have to do with us being unpopular?
Because during 2024, you are going to have a segment of the population that loves Donald Trump and thinks he's going to reverse and kill the deep state.
Okay.
Okay. And you and I are not going to go along with that narrative at all.
No, right.
And we're going to keep pointing out that he's guilty of mass atrocity.
I got you. And a few other things.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So I just saw Steve Bannon do an interview. I think it was on Fox News with Sean Hannity, talking about how they've got their list of people and their plans for the next administration. And they're sure now that I was over that Trump's the next president, you know, and they're going in. So I said to myself, John Titus and I, you know, are going to have to take.
I'll tell you why that won't be a problem. That won't matter, because they're going to, those issues like you're talking about, right, they're going to keep those on the back burner. Listen, between now and November, Trump's going to get nothing but softballs to smash over the fence. And we'll be on the side of Trump smashing the softballs. They're not going to bring up, you know, there's no pandemic, no new virus, nothing.
You and I are going to bring up the fact that betting any hopes on Trump is not going to work.
Yeah, but we're gonna cover stories that are in the news, and the stories that are in the news are not going to be. You're not going to see of COVID 24, whatever.
No. I'm not saying that at all. I'm just saying we're not going to infuse the hope porn with energy.
No. Right. That's okay. To put your hopes on elections is absurd at this point.
Well, but the other thing is, we're not going to, you know, Musk is very popular. So you got Tucker Carlson, Kennedy, and all these people supporting and promoting Musk.
Yeah,
and I'm looking at Musk and I'm saying Musk is the control grid. Why would we support him?
Yeah, he's not real. I mean, start with that.
Right.
It's just, you know, he's like... Right. He's like, you know, there's a backstory with Superman. He's a reporter, Clark Kent. He works.
There's a backstory with Superman. Okay. Yes.
Yeah.
Right.
Same backstory with Musk. They don't even bother to give Musk an engineering degree in his backstory. It's like pathetic. Okay.
Okay.
We'll see what happens anyway. Okay. But let's go to Solari in house with Heroes of the Year. Heroes, yes. Plural of the year.
Talk about real heroes. Let's talk about real people, real heroes. So Senator Frank Nicely and Tennessee Representative Bud Halsey, these are the two legislators who've been part of this group of Republicans who've done remarkable things in Tennessee and who protected the people of Tennessee dramatically during the pandemic, and proof positive that one person can make a huge difference. You never know until you try. And they're Nicely in particular is famous, you know, I have to say in terms of personalities, if you know, sort of if you wanted to have a Damon spirit, Nicely's the spirit of the fox and Halsey's the spirit of the Labrador. He was a policeman for 36 years.
Yeah. And let's play a clip of that.
And Nicely never quits. You know, it took him 7 years to get the sales tax off of precious metals, but he did it. And he just keeps, you know, he just keeps pushing it through. They have an incredible agenda this year. They are really trying to push through legislation, including a bullion depository to protect financial transaction freedom. And what's remarkable is, you know, these are two people who really understand the problem and are doing everything in their power to do something about it. And it's absolutely imperative that anybody in the United States find the Frank Nicely and Bud Halsey of their state and support them, because with a little bit of support, what these guys can get done is just remarkable. So go ahead, show the Halsey video. It's great.
On that point, I retired from the police department after 36 years up here in Kingsport. And one night I stopped this 80-year-old lady, and when I walked up to the door, she said, "I'm supposed to tell you that I'm packing." I said, "Well, that's pretty interesting. What are you carrying?" She said, "Well, I like a 9mm off of Will." She said, "I got one of them in my glove box." I said, "Well, that's pretty neat." She said, "But now I like a 38 too." And she said, "I have one of those right here in the console." And I said, "No kidding. Anything else?" And she said, "Well, what I really like is what you boys carry." She said, "I got a Glock 45 here in the door." And I said, "What in the world are you afraid of?" She said, "Not a darn thing."
Yeah, there you go. I didn't meet him. I met nicely.
Okay, well, you come to Tennessee. We'll arrange for you to meet him, too.
Yeah, okay. Let's keep it going. German farmers again. Pushback of the week.
Speaking of great guys, the European farmers, you know, the Netherlands farmers are amazing, but the German farmers are on the move, and they have figured out my feedback from, you know, and they've continued this week in Berlin, but from a lot of the people in Germany who know the German farmers, they have figured out that this whole agenda is completely, you know, that it's all a lie. You know, the climate change a lie, the sort of things about the nitrogen and all the different excuses why they have to, you know, it's a land grab. They want to kill their business, steal their business, take their land. They figured it out. And so now you've got significant pushback all over Europe. And these are people who have enormous skills and talent and intelligence and are networked. And they have the support. The last poll I saw, 68% of the German people support the farmers, and that's after days of traffic jams.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Next up, up with Dr. Farrell.
Yeah, so our publication, our weekly interview this week is the part two with Dr. Farrell, where we cover both the unanswered questions and go through, instead of doing Bizarro World this time, we did the Great Taking. And I made a list of, for the whole sort of last century, all the different takings. And, you know, John, that was the first time I've ever done that. And there were so many. I thought, it's amazing. We're all standing. And then I listed the anticipated takings, the one being in the securities market. And I explain why I'm not concerned about taking in the securities market. I'm concerned about getting control of, you know, all the transaction platforms, including the banks, and I'm concerned about going after the real assets. So now that you've bubbled trillions of dollars of paper, the race is to get the real assets. And that's why this, you know, when you look at what they're up to with NAICS, they're clearly not going to collapse the securities market because they're planning on another $5 trillion of securities hustle.
Yeah, that's just what they say now. They don't need the paper. Okay, they print the paper. They don't need paper. They need real assets. That's a great point.
Oh, this is a race to grab the real assets, and the NAICS is part of it.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Last in-house is Food for the Soul, European art exhibitions.
Yeah. So Nina Hein is on the moon. She's planning all of her trips on 2024 that she's going to be writing about to all the museums. So she wrote a wonderful thing about the art exhibitions, and the eye candy is beautiful. If you look at some of the different artwork she's published in this, it's great. I did want to mention, because I'm on my way to the United States on Saturday, you know, the hard copy for The Future of Financial Freedom is out. It's really, really good.
Yeah, it's great. I read about half of it. It's fantastic.
I just want to remind everybody, if you're a subscriber, this is in PDF form. You can print it out and give it to your legislators. You know, you can get a bulk copy and distribute it, but get this to your state legislators who are interested, because it's really, really helping them.
Yeah, I'll say, you know, Richard Verner wrote a long piece in there.
Right.
And there are single charts in that publication that reflect hundreds of hours of work.
Right.
I mean, I put charts together. I know how much work it is. There's a lot of work in what Verner does.
He and his team did an incredible job. But you really, you know, we talked about the dangers of if they try and we know they're going to try and consolidate the banking system, but it makes a powerful, powerful case on why you can't let that happen.
It helps that Verner can write too. He writes a good narrative, so it's worth reading for sure.
It's an excellent, excellent piece. A lot of time and effort went in, both by his team and the Salieri team, to get that done and published. It was a big effort.
Yeah, no doubt about that at all.
Yeah, and it even though he writes about Tennessee, the vast majority of it applies to any country or state in the industrial world, so it's very...
Yeah, he makes the case for why you want to bank small. Small banks are the way to go.
They are the way to go.
It's airtight and lucid.
Right, and the thing I love, and we're going to get him back to do this on the Salieri Report, is if you have a great small bank and financial institution infrastructure, you can grow without inflation. It's anyway, so we'll get him back on to make that case, but it's really powerful. Okay, John, well, I'm headed to the United States on Saturday.
And thanks for the warning.
So next week, there's no Money in Markets.
Right. I will see you in a fortnight.
You will see me in a fortnight. And I dare say the amount of pushback we're going to have in the next 2 weeks is...
That's great. I can't wait. Love it.
It's a lot of opportunity. Here's the thing. I said this to one of the legislators the other night. I said, rarely in life do you wake up and find yourself in a time of change where you have this much opportunity to make a difference. So I just tell everybody, you know, the pushback team is having a lot more fun than they did last year. So get out there and, you know, whatever your pushback is, whatever works for you, you want to partake.
Yeah. Pedal to the metal. Yep.
Yep. Yeah. Okay, John, have a great fortnight and I will see you. I will see you from, where will I be? I'll be in Tennessee when I'll see you in Tennessee next. Okay.
Okay, neighbor. I'll see you.
Bye.